Hello, I'm Linda Feinberg, President of FINRA Dispute Resolution. Welcome to another Neutral Workshop. Today we have two distinguished speakers, David Robbins and Jill Gross. David is a partner in the law firm of Kaufman, Gilden, Robbins, and Oppenheim, and specializes in securities arbitration and litigation, employment law, and the representation of individuals in the securities industry. Jill is a professor of law and director of legal skills at Pace University School of Law, teaching mediation and arbitration, professional responsibility, and investor rights clinic. As experienced and frequent arbitrators for FINRA, most often serving as chairpersons, Dave and Jill will offer suggestions on conducting arbitrations in our forum. Before turning the program over to our moderator, Barbara Brady, head of our Neutral Management Department, I want to bring you up to date on two significant initiatives we are taking to further enhance our forum. First, the all-public panel rule. As you know, in February 2011, we implemented a new rule that gives all investors the right to choose an all-public panel. Under the new rule, there are two options for selecting a panel in investor cases: the majority public panel option and the all-public panel option. It is the investor who gets to select the option that governs. With the majority public panel option, the parties will have two public and one non-public arbitrator. With the all-public panel option, the parties may select an all-public panel or, depending on the striking, a majority public panel. Since the rule first went into effect, investors have selected the option that lets them choose an all-public panel 77% of the time. By contrast, investors who have chosen the majority public panel selection option have done so by default 76% of the time. In other words, they've made no election at all, but have defaulted to the majority public panel option. The award results are interesting too. As of April 30, 2013, there have been 146 awards issued after hearing by all public panels under the new rule, and 160 awards issued by majority public panels. To date, the award outcomes show that all public panels awarded damages to investors significantly more often than did majority public panels. In total, investors prevailed 49% of the time in cases decided by all public panels, but only 32% of the time in cases decided by majority public panels. Based on our review of the data, we found that the high percentage of attorneys who default to the majority public panel option, rather than choose it affirmatively or choose the all public panel option, are less experienced in our forum and thus might not fully understand the panel selection options under the rule. Accordingly, we are amending the method by which arbitrators are to be selected. Last month, the FINRA board authorized the filing of a rule proposal that would, if approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission, eliminate the majority public panel selection option altogether. As a result, there would only be one panel composition method for all customer cases in which parties could choose either an all-public panel or a majority public panel. Here's how it would work. In all customer cases with three arbitrators, FINRA would continue to send the party three lists of arbitrators: 10 chair-qualified public arbitrators, 10 public arbitrators, and 10 non-public arbitrators. All parties would continue to be able to strike up to four of the arbitrators from the chair-qualified public arbitrator list and up to four from the public arbitrator list. However, the parties would also be allowed to strike any or all names on the non-public list. We believe that one panel composition method makes sense for several reasons. The proposal will ensure that customers will not missed the opportunity to select an all-public panel because of their inexperience in handling FINRA arbitration matters. Also, it will ensure that every party has an opportunity to see the list of non-public arbitrators and rank or strike any or all of those on that list. Most importantly, it will simplify the arbitrator selection process for all parties, while leaving in place the panel composition method affirmatively chosen by customers in 77% of customer cases. The second issue I want to report on relates to the discovery guide. In 2011, subsequent to SEC approval of the new discovery guidelines, FINRA established a discovery task force made up of investor and firm lawyers. The mission of the task force is to review substantive issues relating to the discovery guide on an ongoing basis, with a goal of keeping the guide current as products change and new discovery issues arise. To date, the task force has focused on developing guidelines relating to e-discovery and product cases. In April, FINRA's board authorized the forum to file a proposal with the SEC to amend the discovery guide, consistent with the recommendations of the task force, to provide general guidance on e-discovery issues and product cases. Specifically, the proposal would amend the introduction of the discovery guide to do the following: to include guidelines for arbitrators to consider when deciding disputes relating to electronic discovery, and to explain that the document production lists generally do not provide for all of the documents usually requested by parties in product cases. The amendments will also clarify that a party may request an affirmation when an opposing party makes only a partial production of documents. Currently, the rule could be misconstrued to provide for affirmations only when none of the documents is produced. Finally, the amendments encourage arbitrators to consider the totality of the circumstances, including the costs and burdens of production, when resolving discovery disputes. For further information about these initiatives, you can go to our website at www.finra.org. I will now turn the workshop over to our moderator, Barbara Brady, and our guest speakers.
Thank you, Linda. In preparing for this workshop, we invited a group of FINRA arbitrators and mediators to identify topics that would be of interest to the neutral roster. In response, several neutrals requested that we explain further the arbitrator selection and appointment process. So let's begin there. The arbitrator selection process begins after all answers are filed or the time to file answers has expired. FINRA's computer system generates, on a random basis, list of arbitrators from FINRA's roster of arbitrators. While staff has no control over this random generation of arbitrator names, staff does review each list for possible conflicts or disclosures between the listed arbitrators and the case being processed. For example, staff reviews the conflicts, disclosures, and employment histories maintained in the arbitrator's disclosure reports. If staff sees that an arbitrator is currently employed by, or currently has an account with, any of the parties to the case, staff will exclude or drop that arbitrator from the list. Each time an arbitrator is dropped from a list, staff documents the reason for the removal to create an audit trail. After staff completes the initial conflicts check, FINRA sends the arbitrator lists to the parties along with a copy of each arbitrator's disclosure report. Upon receipt of the arbitrator lists and disclosure reports, the parties should conduct their own conflicts check in order to make informed selection decisions. For example, it is not uncommon for parties to research arbitrators through Google, to review websites associated with the arbitrator or the arbitrator's employer, and to search social media sites. Accordingly, arbitrators should strive for consistency between their publicly available information and the information they provide in their arbitrator disclosure report. Arbitrators must also update their arbitrator profiles on an ongoing basis to reflect new conflicts, disclosures, education, training, and background information. As a reminder, arbitrators may update their profiles by completing the Arbitrator Information Update form on our website or by using our new online portal for neutrals. Arbitrators who have registered to use the portal may update their profiles from their desktop or laptop computers after logging into the DR portal. After the parties review the list in each arbitrator's disclosure report, the parties then strike and rank the arbitrator's names in order of preference. This process gives the parties a significant voice in selecting the arbitrators who will decide their case. When parties return their ranked arbitrator lists to FINRA, the staff enters these rankings into the computer system, which then consolidates the parties' rankings. The results are the names of those arbitrators who are not struck by the parties in the order of their combined rankings from highest to lowest. Staff then contacts the arbitrators in the order of their ranking to determine if the arbitrators are available for appointment to the case. Once the arbitrator appointment process is complete, arrangements for the initial pre-hearing conference begin.
Barbara, I know from experience that even if an arbitrator is appointed to a case, that doesn't necessarily mean the arbitrator will render an award. Is that right?
You're absolutely correct, David. Not every case results in an arbitrator award. In fact, fewer than 25% of FINRA cases are ultimately decided by the arbitrators. A significant number of cases are either settled or withdrawn prior to the time an award is rendered. Another topic raised by our arbitrators is how to run pre-hearing conferences more effectively. Jill, please share your thoughts on this.
Sure. When I conduct a pre-hearing conference, I have three main goals. First, I follow FINRA's script efficiently. Second, I have the parties select hearing dates with the panel and work backwards from that date to lock in all the other deadlines. And third, I respect the parties' choices and agreements as much as possible. I try to keep the parties focused on the administrative tasks and not allow counsel to sneak in arguments about the merits unless they are relevant somehow to the administrative issues.
David, what do you recommend to help arbitrators conduct a pre-hearing conference?
I'd like to suggest something I do when I chair a FINRA arbitration. It's based on the perceptions I get of some arbitrators when I'm a practitioner, when I represent customers, brokers, or firms. I'm most impressed by panels who give me the impression they take their tasks seriously and are open-minded. When an IPHC, an initial pre-hearing conference, is scheduled, I ask the case administrator to arrange a teleconference with the panel only 15 minutes before the parties join us on the line. During this pre-IPHC, we largely discuss procedural issues that will arise during the IPHC, scheduling hearing dates, discovery deadlines, our thoughts on communication options with the party, with the arbitrators before the hearing, motion practice, and a general understanding of the case. Once we agree on these issues, we can present a united front to the parties, who will be impressed that we took the time to consider the issues. It also gives the panel an opportunity to become comfortable with each other.
The initial pre-hearing conference script contains language about the possible use of the direct communication rule. Dave, I know you're a fan of the direct communication rule. Would you please explain the rule to the arbitrators listening to the workshop?
Sure. Under rules 1221 and 1321, parties and arbitrators may engage in voluntary direct communication provided that all of the parties and the arbitrators agree and provided the parties are represented by counsel. If all parties agree to proceed under the rule, the parties may send directly to the panel only those documents specifically outlined in the initial pre-hearing conference scheduling order.
So what are your respective thoughts about the direct communication rule? Why do you think it isn't used more often?
This is a perfect example of how we as arbitrators can show the parties we care about their case. After all, we're going to have to decide pre-hearing issues eventually. They're not going to go away. And unless a party abuses the direct communication rule, it will always expedite the process. When I chair, I have to frequently convince the parties and my fellow arbitrators that direct communication, which is the standard practice at the American Arbitration Association, enhances the administration of a case. However, I have found that when representing a party in a FINRA arbitration, all too often during the IPHC, the chair either glosses over it in the script or announces without any opportunity for discussion that he or she is against it, without even asking the other two arbitrators. When I question the chair about this during the IPHC, I find that he or she never even tried it in any case. Try it. You can always call it quits if a party is abusing the procedure.
I agree with David completely. I would love to use direct communication in every case, as I think it facilitates a more efficient pre-hearing process and removes the middleman for communication. All too often I learn that a letter or a request from one or more of the parties was inadvertently not forwarded to one or more members of the panel, and delays in arbitrators' decision-making can result. Some arbitrators may be reluctant to agree to direct communication because they fear parties may invade their privacy. In my experience, however, counsel are very respectful of arbitrators and only use email for a case-related important communication. In short, I do not see a downside, and I see a lot of upside.
Thanks. Let's move on to the hearing phase. Jill, the rules require that parties exchange witness lists in advance. What do you consider when a party objects to allowing testimony from a witness who is not previously disclosed on the witness list? And does it make a difference if the witness is an expert witness?
Barbara, I inquire first as to the reasons a witness was not previously disclosed, consider whether the witness is offered on a party's principal case or for rebuttal. I assess possible prejudice to the objecting party and ultimately determine what is the fairest outcome. I really prefer not to rule in a manner that condones parties who flout the rules that do require advance disclosure of witnesses. If the witness in question is an expert, it seems even less excusable for a party to not include that expert on the pre-hearing exchange witness list unless the expert is offered to rebut the opposing party's expert.
David, anything to add? What factors do you consider in deciding whether to allow the witness's testimony?
Well, Barbara, as arbitrators, our guiding principle should be fairness to all the parties. Arbitration by ambush should not be permitted. If a party was not disclosed, if a witness was not disclosed in the 20-day notice, and the name wasn't given to the opposing attorney, even within the 20 days leading up to the hearing, I would generally prohibit that witness from testifying, unless there's a real good reason for not disclosing the witness's name. Fairness should dictate. That means giving the other side an opportunity to prepare for the cross-examination of that witness. If the opposing party doesn't have that opportunity and wants it, then the witness should be invited back to the next hearing for direct and cross. And does it make a difference if it's a fact witness or an expert? No.
David, Rules 12604 and 13604 of the Code state that the panel will decide what evidence to admit and that the panel is not required to follow state or federal rules of evidence. What do you take into consideration when a party objects to the relevance or reliability of pro-offered evidence? And what do you do when a party makes repeated frivolous objections?
Well, at the outset of the hearing, I tell the parties that all the documents they want to get into evidence will be admitted unless there's a very good reason for exclusion. I tell them that they can call all the witnesses in their 20-day notices. I tell them that the rules of evidence don't apply and to not make objections unless the questions have been asked and answered. However, I also tell them that in exchange for this liberal admission of documents and witnesses, they have the obligation not to be repetitive, not to introduce exhibits just for the sake of putting in documents not to waste our time. I ask them to give us credit for knowing the issues. If a chair says these things to the parties at the outset, there simply are few frivolous objections made, and when they are made, they should be handled with strength and humor by the chair.
Jill, what's your approach?
Well, like David, typically I will permit each party to present all evidence as it is relevant to the issues in the case and not prejudicial to the objecting party in some way, which it rarely is. In my view, the panel's job is to hear and consider all relevant documents and testimony. Anything that will help the panel in its deliberations should be admitted into evidence. As for frivolous objections, I remind counsel that this is arbitration, not a courtroom trial, and thus the rules of evidence don't apply. Second, I also remind counsel that the panel wants to facilitate the witnesses providing helpful testimony, and these kinds of frivolous objections can prevent us from hearing useful and relevant testimony. Usually, by firmly and promptly overruling frivolous objections without extended colloquy among counsel, they get the message and stop.
Jill, is there a proper way and time for arbitrators to ask questions during the presentation of a case?
My preference is for arbitrators not to ask questions of a witness until all counsel have completed their examination of that witness. Usually, one of the lawyers will cover the question anyway, thus obviating the need for a panelist to ask the question. Occasionally, a question is necessary in the middle of testimony just to clarify a particular fact or a particular answer or perhaps a time frame. When asking a question, an arbitrator should frame it as neutrally as possible so as to not risk revealing any bias, any preconceived judgments, or even the perception of bias about or judgments about the merits.
David and Jill, you often serve as chairpersons. Jill, what are some of your hints on how to control the hearing?
Barbara, I like to establish rapport with all counsel by demonstrating that I intend to conduct as fair a hearing as possible. I indicate early on that the arbitrators will respect the party's agreement as to any procedural issues as long as the level playing field is maintained. At the same time, I try to subtly demonstrate that I will not tolerate incivility or disrespectful conduct. I also like to maintain a sense of humor to make everyone more comfortable in the room.
David, what works for you? How do you control the air?
I've found that a relaxed atmosphere works best. Not an informal hearing, but one in which there is a give and take between the panel and the parties so that the parties can early on see that the panel wants to understand the issues and not stand on ceremony. As a practitioner, I have found that many hearings are way too serious. Everyone is uptight, or you'll have hearings where the chair lets the parties control the process. Relax. Take witnesses out of turn if necessary. Keep the hearings moving along. Give the parties your undivided attention for the full day. Show them you care, and they will respond accordingly. Of course, I make sure one of my fellow arbitrators is responsible for recording the hearing.
That's so important, Dave. The audio recordings of the hearings are critical. The recordings may be necessary to a party's petition to vacate or confirm an award. Sometimes they capture information that becomes the subject of a disciplinary proceeding. And on a regular basis, the recordings help staff respond to complaints about the conduct of an arbitration proceeding. Jill, any tips for arbitrators you feel might not be comfortable operating the recording equipment?
Well, if an arbitrator is not comfortable using the equipment, then that arbitrator should ask another panelist to take over, or ask for further instructions from someone more knowledgeable in the room, or a FINRA staff person. All arbitrators should watch the free video training offered on FINRA's website on how to operate the digital recorder. The arbitrator assigned to ensure that the hearing is recorded, whoever that arbitrator ends up to be, should practice using the recorder before the hearing. Also, if the chairperson sees the arbitrator uncomfortable with the recording, then that chairperson might consider asking another panelist to record the session.
Thanks. David, FINRA has, on occasion, received complaints from parties when an arbitrator announces at the outset of, say, a three-day hearing that he or she must cut the third day short, perhaps to catch a flight. As chairperson, what do you do when this occurs?
Well, during that pre-IPHC that I mentioned before, we discuss our schedules and what FINRA and the parties expect of us. One of those things is a full hearing day. I ask my fellow arbitrators not to schedule anything else that could conflict with our providing a full day's service, and that this should be altered only for an actual emergency.
Jill, let's address the flip side of the scenario. The arbitrators have blocked out significant time to conduct hearings, only to learn the night before that the parties settled. Any tips for how they can anticipate or react to this event?
Well, it can be frustrating for arbitrators to hear that a case is settled the night before a hearing, but the parties have a right to resolve their dispute at any time and in any way they see fit. Since arbitration is a process based on consent of the parties, if the parties no longer need the process to resolve the dispute, then the arbitrator should respect that. FINRA does compensate arbitrators somewhat with last-minute adjournment fees to acknowledge the inconvenience to the arbitrators.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, we asked arbitrators to suggest topics for the panel to consider. One arbitrator offered a tip that worked for him, and I'm curious to hear your reactions. The arbitrator explained that he had an arbitration that lasted for 3 weeks and involved a great deal of data. Each party submitted 10 three-ring binders full of information. The panel asked each of the parties to outline their key points in written summaries and limited the number of pages. The arbitrator reported that this approach compelled the parties to focus on the information each considered most important. Jill, what are your thoughts on this technique? Have you ever tried anything similar?
Well, I definitely support the approach as long as it doesn't deprive a party of its right to a full and fair hearing. Too often the parties don't focus in on the key issues in dispute, and the arbitrators have a hard time sifting through the voluminous record to get to the crux of the matter. If this approach helps the arbitrators reach the right result, I am all for it. In terms of whether I've done something like this similar, I have asked the parties to submit a very short letter brief on a particular issue if that issue is unclear to me or my fellow panelists. And so any device that will help clarify issues for the arbitrator, I think, is a very important approach to use in arbitration.
David, have you ever tried this technique? And if so, what was your experience?
Well, I think it's a great idea. It's been my experience, and I've been doing a securities arbitrations since the early 1980s, that no case involves more than two or three issues on liability or more than a couple of issues on damages. Every case can be simplified. And when the parties are compelled to do that, they usually meet the task.
Okay, another arbitrator contacted us with an interesting question. What should arbitrators do when they learn that a registered representative or firm has engaged in misconduct, but the case settles before the panel issues a decision? For example, an arbitrator hears evidence that one registered representative has signed another registered representative's name on official forms without the legal authority to do so. Jill, what can the arbitrator do in that instance?
An arbitrator should consider referring the matter to FINRA for disciplinary investigation. Keep in mind that FINRA rules preclude an arbitrator from initiating a regulatory referral until the case has concluded either by award or settlement. In general, an arbitrator should only refer matters that are of a regulatory interest. A referral may be appropriate if the conduct of the brokerage house or associated person demonstrates substantial ethical or dishonest conduct by a member firm or its associated person. It may be appropriate if the conduct of the brokerage house or associated person may have violated securities laws or FINRA rules. If the misconduct involves abusive sales or trading practices, which include churning, unsuitable recommendations, misrepresentation in the sale of securities, unauthorized transactions, failure to reasonably supervise, or misuse or conversion of funds or securities. A disciplinary referral may be made against FINRA firms and their associated persons. Note that the firm or the associated person need not be a party to the arbitration. Also, a disciplinary referral does not require the consent of the majority of the panel. A single arbitrator may initiate a disciplinary referral. Although a majority of the panel is not required, arbitrators are encouraged to discuss the matter with their fellow panelists.
Thank you. So, before we wrap up, Jill and Dave, would each of you conclude by offering arbitrators three things they should try the next time they arbitrate?
Three things. Well, Barbara, I would say, first, make every effort to be on time and allow the parties as much time in the course of a day to present evidence. Second, ask questions of witnesses at the end of their testimony if you need clarification or further explanation, particularly if it's of a critical issue. And third, if chairing a hearing, be as transparent as possible in your rulings so the parties have guidance as to how to conduct themselves for the remainder of the hearing.
Barb, I have two main takeaways I'd like to stress. One, arbitrator's equitable authority, and arbitrator's power to move a case along without fear of an award vacature. The first point, this is arbitration and not litigation, no matter how hard the attorneys try to change it. And arbitration is guided by the rules of equity. The law in New York and most other states on the issue of arbitration as a forum of equity is that arbitrators are not bound to abide by principles of substantive law or rules of procedure which govern the traditional litigation process, absent a contrary provision in the arbitration agreement. An arbitrator's paramount responsibility is to reach an equitable result. At the end of the day, we as arbitrators want to feel that we did justice in our award. We want to believe that our decision is the right one and that it has integrity. New York's highest court says this about us: he may do justice as he sees it, applying his own sense of law and equity to the facts as he finds them to be. His award will not be vacated, even though the court concludes that he misapplied substantive rules of law, unless it is violative of a strong public policy, or is totally irrational, or exceeds a specifically enumerated limitation on his power. In FINRA arbitrations, as in all arbitrations, there is a constant balancing act that we must achieve between law and equity, based on the evidence, to apply the law in an equitable manner. And my last point on arbitrator's power to move a case along without fear of arbitration award vacature: arbitrators should be emboldened by the knowledge that since a losing party's challenge to their award will usually fail, we should promptly establish and thereafter maintain control of the case to its conclusion. As long as we provide a fundamentally fair hearing to all the parties, don't engage in ex parte communications with a party or party representative, don't refuse to permit a party to cross-examine witnesses, give each party an opportunity to complete his or her presentation of proof, decide only the issues set forth in the pleadings, decide all the issues submitted, disclose information about ourselves that satisfy our obligation to be impartial, have a reasonable basis for the denial of a request to adjourn or the refusal to hear certain evidence, and as long as our awards are not completely irrational, not contrary to a well-defined and dominant public policy, and are not lacking a factual basis, there is little fear from the courts that our awards will be overturned. So I want to conclude with this. Take control of the process. The parties will appreciate the fact that with a firm hand, you are expeditiously and fairly hearing their dispute and rendering your award.
This is Linda Feinberg again. I want to thank our distinguished speakers, David Robbins and Jill Gross, for taking time from their busy schedules to participate in today's workshop. And thanks also to our moderator, Barbara Brady, and to our staff administrator, Jeremy Zelliger, who helped us prepare this presentation. And thanks to all of you who listened to our workshop and for your service as arbitrators in our forum. If you have any questions about anything that was discussed today, feel free to email them to us at arbitratorsurveys@finra.org. Again, that's arbitratorsurveys, as one word, at finra.org. We will answer them in the next edition of the Neutral Corner. Thank you and goodbye.